This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The COVID-19 vaccines have rolled out, and frontline healthcare workers and the nation's most vulnerable population are receiving the shots. But how's the process playing out? We'll spend the next hour looking at the local handling of the vaccine distribution, those who are hesitant to receive it, and whether such vaccines can be mandatory at workplaces. We start with Dr. Dustin Calhoun, UC Health Medical Director for Emergency Management and Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Calhoun, welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having us on, sir.
It's so good to have you back on. This is still a scary time, obviously, as we remain in the grips of this COVID pandemic. But a lot of us are starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel. Is that a correct feeling to have with the vaccine distribution starting, despite how it's going so far? Is it right to see that an end is possibly in sight?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the light at the end of the tunnel is a very reasonable analogy. The caveat that I always add to that every time it's used is that it is a long tunnel, and the light is a good ways away. And there are a lot of things that we need to continue doing in that tunnel, such as social distancing, mask wearing, hygiene, all that kind of thing. We need to continue to do that until quite a ways down the road, but absolutely. And I don't know that I would say that I don't know that I'd use the term despite the way vaccine distribution has been going. It's an extremely complicated thing. And we have vaccinated thousands of people in Southwest Ohio already, thousands of people within our own healthcare system already. So I think we are moving in the right direction for a cure.
Well, we are going to talk a little bit about how that process is going and your intimate role in that. But help us understand a little bit more. I think it's important that we emphasize what it means when the vaccine finally reaches all of our individual arms and the amount of time that it's going to take to do that, because you mentioned we are still going to be socially distancing. We are still going to be wearing masks. Can you explain to us why that is?
Well, there's a number of reasons. No vaccine is perfect. These two vaccines that we're currently rolling out are as close as you get, just about. The numbers are very, very impressive, but there are always going to be some. It also takes time to get enough of the population vaccinated in order to get what everybody keeps hearing about, that concept of herd immunity. That's a ways down the road. And then the other thing that we don't quite know yet is we know that the vaccine does an excellent job of protecting us against getting the symptoms of COVID-19. We don't know completely whether or not it actually completely prevents us from transmitting it to someone else. When you get a vaccine, you still get the virus in you. Your body is just able to fight it off. The question still is out there a little bit as to whether in that fighting it off process, you could still spread it. So that's the main reason we really need to continue protecting until we have a lot more information.
How do we go about getting that information? I would imagine that a lot of people are paying very close attention to how this plays out after people are vaccinated. But can you talk about if you know of anything related to a timeline or what type of data people in that position are going to need before they conclude what it really means once we're vaccinated as it relates to the damage that the virus could do?
So I think it's sort of two sides. One side is sort of the research arm of that, of looking at what is going on as we get the vaccine. We know lots about that as far as the safety of it goes, the efficacy for the individual. The information as to how it affects whether you can transmit it is something that's being actively looked at through research studies. The other side of it is that concept of herd immunity, that concept of reduced transmission. And that's something that we're going to get as we continue to monitor our prevalence rates, as we continue to monitor our infection rates in the community. And we don't have a way to predict when it's going to reach a point where we would be comfortable saying, you know, you don't necessarily have to wear a mask everywhere you go. But we know that we're not there yet, and we definitely want people to recognize that just getting that vaccine in their arm is not a ticket to take the mask off yet. It is definitely a ticket to improved health and safety for them and their family, but just not quite yet to get rid of the mask.
We're talking with Dr. Dustin Calhoun. He is the UC Health Medical Director for Emergency Management, as well as an Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine. We'll talk to us a little bit, Dr. Calhoun, about how it's going here. This is obviously a significant mission that healthcare workers like you are executing. What's it look like on the front lines?
Busy. busy. I have to give the massive amount of credit to folks in our organization, like our pharmacy and our director of pharmacy, VP of pharmacy, Shelley Wiest, just doing an amazing job with getting this vaccine out. And then folks like Dr. Edgy advocating for the residents and for the physicians and all the other healthcare workers, and having a huge role in helping us to prioritize a very large organization. I'm sure you are aware of the governor, the great shout out that he gave to our region and to our healthcare system, which was a really nice thing to hear that, that the work we're doing is being recognized. We've had great success as far as rapidly using vaccine. We have been able to use the vaccine and get it into the appropriate people as fast as we wanted to. You know, we're certainly not receiving vaccine and using all however many thousand doses we get at a time that day, when we wouldn't want to do that. That would leave significant gaps in who's getting it. You know, if you can't be there that day, then you can't get it. And that's not equitable or best for our region. But we are using up vaccine within days of receiving it. So I think we're being as efficient as we can in getting it out there and getting the effect that we're looking for.
You just referenced Dr. Luito Edgy of the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, and she will be our guest right after this segment to talk about those who might feel some hesitance to have the vaccine administered to them. But talk to us about what that means, what you just said. You said that you're getting this out as fast as you thought you wanted to. And, you know, we're reading different reports from various parts of the country that perhaps this isn't going as quickly as possible. Can you expand upon what you just said? You know, you're talking about not wanting to administer all of the vaccines as they're received for, I guess, procedural reasons. Can you help us understand?
Yeah, sure. And it's minimal delays. We're talking about receiving it, and every single shipment we have gotten, we have initiated using it the day that we got it, from the very first 175 doses we got from Pfizer to the week later getting 3,100 doses. We began putting that vaccine into people's arms that day that we received it. But if you were to, which we could, put every single of those 3,100 doses out that day, you would have a harder time, if not an impossible time, getting it into the right people. Because just because someone has commitments that keep them from being able to get there, let's say the person who's on duty working in the ICU might not actually be able to break away for that entire period. And then you have a critical person who should be getting vaccinated that can't. So we have intentionally spread it out over a few days. Again, initiating it immediately as soon as we have the vaccine and then getting it out within a few days in order to just increase the equity by which we're distributing it, making sure we're getting it into people who have risk for getting COVID, have risk for having a bad outcome from COVID, and those folks that we really need to make sure we're protecting in order to protect our healthcare system's ability to do what it does. That always is fundamental for us, is as the only regional adult level one trauma center, a comprehensive stroke center, and you know, all of the other unique services that UC Health provides to the region, we have to make sure that we're protecting the personnel who can do those things regardless of their risk of COVID from what they do. So all of those factors blend together. And you can imagine that with the complexity of that, that's where some of the delays come. We've been very lucky. And, you know, some of that luck, or a lot of that luck, is from pre-planning. We planned to do this so that we knew how we were going to make the decisions. And as the decisions came up, we were just able to make them and move forward. But it's a super complex process that if the pre-planning hasn't gone, or one little piece is out of place, there can be some significant delays. And I'm sure that's what's being seen in other parts of the country. But we've been very fortunate to avoid those here at UC Health in Cincinnati.
Tell us more about that planning process. What does the vaccine pipeline look like? We know that this Operation Warp Speed program and other similar programs around the world led to the rapid creation of these unprecedented vaccines. But once they're created and they're in the manufacturing center and they're shipped out, what's the pipeline for when they're finally put in someone's arm? Where do they land here? And then when did they get to people like you to administer?
Sure. So because of the volume that we're using, we're a large enough center, we're getting them directly from the manufacturer. Later on, there will be folks that are getting them through their local Department of Health and things like that. But we get them directly from the manufacturer. There is regulation through state government, ODH, as to the quantities that go from the manufacturer, but it does come directly shipped from them. We receive that and immediately, obviously, take a survey of what we've gotten and then put into the appropriate controls. The two different vaccines have very different controls that are required, safety measures. So we do those things. And then what we have done is each day we both, or the shipments we've received have all been in the morning. We immediately get it all into the appropriate storage facility in our hospital. We take out what we have already planned to be able to use that day. And sometimes that planning, just because of all the variables at the manufacturing level and shipping level, we may have a lot of notice. 24 hours has been pretty reasonable notice for us lately. So we may have been doing that planning the night before as to exactly what we're going to do the next day, because you just don't know the exact times. But we have that set. We pull out the number of vaccines that we're planning to administer that day, because again, once you have put this stuff to room temperature, it has a much shorter lifespan. We take that up into the areas that we've pre-designated for administering vaccine. We already have people scheduled to be there to receive it. The pharmacists start drawing it up and administering. So the chain from once they produce it to once we start using it is actually relatively streamlined and relatively simple, even though some of the steps along the way have some complexity to them.
We are talking with Dr. Dustin Calhoun, UC Health Medical Director for Emergency Management. I want to note something the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Balmert reported just this morning about a nursing home in Lawrence County. That's at the southern tip of Ohio, not in our area, of course, but apparently a nursing home there requested too many COVID-19 vaccines from a Walgreens, and so they inoculated staff and residents. The pharmacy, according to this report, had about 195 doses of COVID-19 vaccine, or 39 vials, left over. And so the pharmacy reallocated 13 vials to other nursing home locations and distributed 19 vials to residents 65 years and older, as well as employees of the pharmacy. But 35 doses of that vaccine expired. And that's got to be disappointing to read for a lot of people who are wondering when our number's going to be called. Have we experienced anything like that here, where we've lost some doses due to some planning errors?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So we have taken great measures to prevent that. We have had some situations where we had less people for various reasons, family emergencies, those kind of things, show up to get their vaccine. So we have had our crews, the pharmacy team, work late into the night a few times in order to use up the vaccine that was thawed, and again, use it up in the appropriate people, making sure that we're getting folks in the right phases of our distribution. But absolutely not. We have not wasted a single dose. In truth, we've actually not created any doses, but we've taken measures to make sure we're getting every single drop we can. You know, things that I didn't even realize before this, there are significant differences in needle efficiencies. Different needle systems have different amounts of little tiny couple of drops of leftover in them. And by using the most efficient needle systems, we have been able to get, the pharmacy team has been able to get extra doses out of a number of these vials. So of the first 975 doses that we received from the Pfizer shipment, we actually administered vaccine to 1,105 people because of being very efficient with drawing the vaccine out of those vials. So we not only have not wasted any, we have essentially created extra doses based on the way it's packaged.
Dr. Calhoun, before we let you run, I know you're very busy. The two vaccines that are available to Americans right now are both requiring a booster. So they get the initial shot, and then there's another one a certain amount of time later. How are you preparing for that second dose? Because when these original folks are getting that second dose, you'll still be working to administer the first dose to so many other people. Any worry at all about being overwhelmed by that?
So I don't have any worry about being overwhelmed by it. It is something we take very seriously and have had to put quite a bit of work on. The pharmacy team has put quite a bit of work into organizing that, because we do need to be able to do both. We can't just completely stop first doses to be starting the second doses. And you do have to be clearly keeping track of which dose, because if you got Pfizer initially, you need a Pfizer dose on the second end. And I do have to commend the organization of this at the state and federal level and the manufacturer's level. And they have been given very solid assurances that we are willing to trust that each dose we get, we will be getting that second dose at either 21 or 28 days, depending on Pfizer versus Moderna. So that's allowed us to fully utilize the vaccine that we have as per their plan without having to hold it back. And that has occurred. We received the appropriate amount of Pfizer doses for the second dosing round that we're doing this week. So that has certainly a serious consideration, but we don't see that as being a significant problem. Where I thought you were actually going to go was which of the vaccines people should pick, because that's a really common question that we get. And you know, my stock answer to that, which is still borne out in the evidence, is to take the first vaccine that's available to you, whether that's Pfizer or Moderna. Their efficacy and safety is very much on par.
But you should get the booster that corresponds to the original one?
Absolutely, yes. If you got Pfizer the first time, you should get Pfizer the second, Moderna the first time, Moderna the second, mostly because that is the way the studies are designed, and that's how we know you get efficacy. And you should get the second dose. The best evidence we have says that about 10 days after the first dose, you have about 80% effectiveness. And then about 7 days after your second dose, you have the maximum amount of efficacy you're going to get, which we're finding to be about 95% in both vaccines.
Dr. Dustin Calhoun is UC Health Medical Director for Emergency Management and an Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Calhoun, thanks for coming back on, and I do hope we can take some of your time again very soon. Good luck out there.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me on.
Our pleasure. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Though the new COVID vaccines are being administered around the world and here in Cincinnati, as a sign the pandemic could finally be behind us someday soon, some Americans will refuse it. So what could the impact of that be? We're joined now by University of Cincinnati College of Medicine Assistant Dean of Graduate Medical Education, Dr. Luido Edgy. Dr. Edgy, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. You know, we talked before on this program, before COVID arrived on our shores, about vaccination skeptics related to a variety of illnesses and diseases. It's a conversation that's been around for many, many years. With this particular one involving a disease that has so impacted our everyday lives, what are you hearing about concerns about this particular vaccine, especially because of how quickly it came on?
So a couple of different things. I'd probably put them into four different areas. First of all, people being very concerned about the side effects of the vaccine as probably the number one thing. The second really would be the fear of the speed at which it was actually developed. And I think it was really unfortunate that it was given the word or the term Operation Warp Speed, just because, you know, that implied that maybe corners were going to be cut. And really, that was not the case at all. We've been studying coronaviruses at the NIH for at least two decades. And so really, the push in the last 11 months was really to go ahead and make sure that we understood the spike protein on the outside of the virus, the part that is most infectious. And therefore, really, that was sequenced within 66 days of the beginning of the pandemic. And then the rest of the time was spent dealing with the phases of the different trials and getting the individuals involved in the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine trials set to go.
So if you're talking to someone who maybe previously wasn't skeptical of vaccinations, but does have concerns about this one, you think you'd be able to convince them about the efficacy and safety of it?
I think there are a couple things that need to happen with any conversation around vaccine hesitancy. The first is really to come to that conversation with respect. The second is compassion, and the third is patience. Typically, these conversations are not going to be single conversations. It usually needs to be multiple conversations over time. And acknowledging some of the very difficult truths that have littered the past, especially, for example, in Black and Latinx communities, wherein there's a lot of suspicion around some government-sanctioned studies that were done, such as Tuskegee.
And again, we're talking with Dr. Luido Edgy. She is the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine Assistant Dean of Graduate Medical Education. Dr. Edgy, I understand that you participated in one of the trials?
I did. I participate and still am participating in the Moderna trial. And that happened shortly after I had the death of my stepmother. Oh. She was young. She was healthy. And within 8 days, she was taken from us. Because Moderna was actually going to be at our institution, it was one of the 90 sites, I decided this was going to be very convenient for me to be involved in. I thought it was very important as a Black female physician to have some credibility in talking to patients who look like myself to get them convinced that this trial was something to be involved in. I also had not been married yet for a full year, and so had a really important conversation with my husband. He was concerned that I not be involved in a trial that had any virus in it. And so that narrowed it down to Moderna and Pfizer both. And again, because of the proximity to my actual work, that narrowed it down to Moderna in particular.
Well, we're so sorry for the loss of your stepmother. It's such a tragedy that so many of us and our people who are close to us have experienced. And it's one of the reason I think probably the most driving reason that so many of us want to put this behind us. But we did talk to some people in our audience and in our community about their feelings on the upcoming vaccine. Cincinnati Edition assistant producer Nick Swartzel spoke with a woman who is hesitant about the vaccine. Let's listen to what she had to say.
Hi, my name is Tangeray, and I live in downtown Cincinnati. As an African-American woman who is aware of the unethical human experimentation in the United States, specifically as it relates to Black and brown bodies, I will not be taking the COVID-19 vaccine. We're in the United States only one generation removed from the Tuskegee experiment, where 600 African-American men were told that they were receiving free health care from the government, when the true purpose of the study was actually to observe the natural history of untreated syphilis. We're only one generation removed from Henrietta Lacks, and we're three generations removed from J. Marion Sims, dubbed the father of modern gynecology due to his experimentation on enslaved women. 6 years ago, California Governor Jerry Brown had to sign a bill into law banning prisons from sterilizing inmates without their consent, as if that should not be a given. A few months ago, we learned that forced sterilization continued at our nation's border. In the 1990s, HIV transmission was used as a dog whistle to justify the police-involved shootings of African Americans. There was no rapid response from Big Pharma or from the government to develop a vaccine against a virus that disproportionately affected African Americans and queer communities still to this day. Today, the vaccine trials have targeted poor populations of color. Listening to Black Talk Radio or reading print media written by people of color, urging folks in the area to participate. I received correspondence through the mail offering me $1,200 to participate in the vaccine trial. My partner asked, I wonder how they found you, and I kind of gave him the side eye, like, you know. After 400 years of disenfranchisement, now, all of a sudden, we're supposed to expect the best intention.
Dr. Edgy, Tangeray there speaks to what you referenced earlier in our conversation, distrust among African Americans because of the history. So how do you respond to those types of feelings?
Yeah. So number one, acknowledgement, because she is speaking some very, very uncomfortable truths, truths that are within my own family included. So just acknowledgement off the front end of it. The second thing is just to make sure that, you know, we inform people about things that have been put into place to address this. For example, IRBs, those are institutional review boards that are groups of people who actually look at studies and make sure that before anyone is involved in a trial, enrolled in a trial, that there are plans to make sure that these things do not happen again. One thing I will say specifically with Moderna is that even though it was started before the Pfizer trial, it actually was halted partway through just so that we could make sure that we had equal representation within the trial to reflect the general population. I think it's very important that, let's say, things had rolled out perfectly as they have from the standpoint of efficacy and safety, that we still have credibility when it comes to the fact that, yes, these trials were actually done in people and reflect people of color. I would hate for it to have been a situation where only Caucasian patients were enrolled in Moderna, and then the hesitancy was because African-American patients and Latinx patients were thinking, well, we weren't involved in the study at all, so how do you know it works on us? So again, Moderna halted the study to make sure that we reflect the exact population percentage in the study as there is in the general population.
We're joined by University of Cincinnati College of Medicine Assistant Dean of Graduate Medical Education, Dr. Luito Edgy. WVXU reporter Jolene Amendarez spoke with several people at Findlay Market. Joe Bailey, told Jolene that he won't be one of the first. While he may consider the vaccine later, he's taking a wait-and-see approach.
I plan on not taking them. I'm going to let other people take them first. A lot of times the disenfranchised, the poor people, is often the guinea pigs for these vaccines. I'm going to wait on this and see how it goes. A lot of these vaccines, it's just come out. It needs a year to really see what's the side effects and all the harmful things it might cause. And then a year down, we had places, you had Johnson & Johnson with the baby powder, talking powder, Roundup, and we found out they know about all the side effects, and then now people got cancer and died from these so-called vaccines. But, you know, I congratulate those who want to be brave enough to go first and take this this vaccine, but I'm not one of those people.
And Dr. Edgy, there's someone who seems willing to take the vaccine after seeing what happens with other people, and again raising what you might characterize as hard truths related to other medical discoveries. How do you respond to Joe?
That Joe wasn't going to be the first in line. That is what our job was as trial participants. I am one of 30,000 people in the Moderna trial who volunteered to be the first group that this is tried on. We went into this with our eyes wide open. We read the informed consent and decided that this was a calculated risk that we were willing to take. And so 30,000 of us came into the study. Of those who were vaccinated, nobody who was vaccinated actually got severe COVID, which would mean that they did not get hospitalized or die of COVID. And so again, we were, quote, the guinea pigs, the ones who were in the trial, so that other people would not have to be first in line.
WVXU reporter Julie Namandaras also spoke with Stacey Dworak at Findlay Market. She also wants to wait and see.
I want to see what happens, honestly. I have mixed emotions about it, or feelings, I guess. It's scary at the end of the day. I also am a person that doesn't really get flu shots. So I guess I want to see, I know one person that's already had it, like the trial, and he seems to be fine. I just want to see how it happens to work. And if it starts to solve the pandemic, then I think I would be, you know, more interested in doing it, being that I've worked almost through it for almost the whole time.
Dr. Reggie, there's another semi-skeptic of how this might play out, somebody who wants to wait and see and watch what happens. Can you help us understand the challenge that this could present to us? Because we do need to reach a certain percentage of inoculation in this country in order to return to something that we might recognize as normal.
Absolutely. So two parts to that. First off, there are about 150,000 healthcare workers here in the community. And as we get our vaccines and live in the communities and go to the grocery stores and so forth, people will see that we're doing just fine with our vaccines. Secondly, I'm going ahead and making sure that all of us healthcare workers are educated on the efficacy of the vaccine and its safety, because information from the Kaiser Family Foundation Vaccine Monitor really does show that there is some hesitancy within our healthcare workers as well. Additionally, I think the biggest issue as well is to make sure that people understand that herd immunity can happen several different ways. We have to have about 70% of people immune, either because they had COVID and got antibodies that way, or because they got the vaccine. Now, what we do know about having COVID itself is that the antibody response there is variable, and we do not know how long it actually lasts. We do know, however, that if you've got the COVID vaccine, that you actually do have a very robust response as far as immunity, and that it does include the neutralizing antibody, which helps to be protective. The other thing is that from the Moderna trial in particular, we know that if you go ahead and have conferred immunity or you're immune by about the fourth month, then the likelihood of the immunity lasting for a year to 2 years is very high. The reason that I am in the trial for a full 25 months is so that I can help our scientists understand how long the immunity from this this vaccine will last.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Luito Edgy, University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Assistant Dean of Graduate Medical Education. I want to note, obviously, the politics that have surrounded COVID-19 mitigation efforts since the beginning of this pandemic. It seems that lockdown measures, business closures, even face mask and social distancing regulations have been politicized. Do you have concerns at all that those politics have or will filter into the conversation about the vaccine?
Oh, absolutely, I do. As a physician, I take care of Republicans and I take care of Democrats, regardless of their politics. But we also do know that the word hoax has been something that has been thrown around as a concern. And we also do know, again, from the Kaiser Family Foundation Vaccine Monitor, that 42% of Republicans have said that they would not take the vaccine. We also do know that rural residents are less likely to take it, Black adults, essential workers, independents, and then healthcare workers. So while we have science, we do have an uphill battle with some of the things that have been politicized. Again, that's something that usually will require probably more than one conversation with a skeptical individual. And I really do encourage people to utilize the trust that they have with their healthcare providers to sit down and start the conversation, because in the end, it's those who are your loved ones that will leave a void that you cannot replace once they're gone. At this point, I have had now a total of 4 members. You know, again, I got enrolled because of 1 death in my family. It is now up to 4. So the speed at which we're able to get this message out, the speed at which we're able to go ahead and get people vaccinated with true immunity will lessen the number of people and the number of families who have got voids at their dining tables.
The Kaiser Family Foundation survey that you referenced also found that 33% of essential workers, like grocery store workers, police officers, firefighters, and 29% of people in the healthcare field said they would probably not get a vaccine. Is that concerning to you?
Absolutely. And being a member of health system leadership, I think it's extremely important for hospitals across the country to not only try and educate patients, but also to have some very detailed and pointed efforts within their own health systems to educate their essential workers and also healthcare workers.
And so, again, as we wait for our own numbers to be called, those of us who are willing to be vaccinated when the time comes, what's your general message to folks? I guess basically as it relates to patients, because it's not you're going to get your shot, you're going to get your booster, and then the all clear comes. There's going to be a certain amount of time we're going to be waiting, right?
Absolutely. This is a marathon. This is not a sprint. What we'll need to do, as Dr. Calhoun had mentioned, is continue to do the things that we know that have kept those of us who are safe currently safe. And that is wearing a mask, making sure that you're socially distanced, and making sure that you're washing your hands always. And as long as we continue with those measures, that will help us to weather through this storm. Again, this is going to be a marathon, and we need to make sure that our mindset is set for that. I believe that the more people realize that we're going to be doing well down the line, the more likely they're going to go ahead and get in line for those shots.
University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Assistant Dean of Graduate Medical Education, Dr. Luito Edgy. Dr. Edgy, thank you so much for the time you gave us. Hope we can talk again soon.
Thank you for this platform.
And up next, will your employer be able to make up your mind for you on the vaccine? We discuss the possibility of workforce vaccine mandates. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. As you weigh whether to get the vaccine for COVID when your number is called, will your employer be able to mandate it? I spoke earlier with Graydon attorney Lee Geiger about that. Here's our pre-recorded interview. Lee Geiger, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
You know, a lot of us are looking at the schedule as it relates to COVID-19 vaccines and wondering when we can get in line for that. Of course, there are others who are a little more timid about it and want to see maybe some results or don't have any interest in taking it at all. We're talking today about the role of employers in this conversation and whether it's something that employers should mandate. Just in general, where are you on that as an attorney?
You know, the standard attorney answer is it depends. And I think it really depends on the industry that the company is in and the risk factors and whether or not the company wants to mandate the vaccines. There are pros and cons to mandating it.
Well, let's talk about some of those. What would the pros be?
The pros would be that you know that your workforce has been vaccinated against COVID-19. And so, therefore, you reduce the risk of having employees that are missing work because of COVID-19. You also reduce the risk of, you know, the expenses that come with that lost work.
And as for the cons?
The cons would be, first, it's going to be difficult to administer. You've got to have somebody that's going to make sure that they're tracking whether or not every employee has received the vaccine. You also have to deal with exceptions to the mandatory vaccinations. And those are probably going to fall primarily into two categories. Those would be for individuals with a disability and individuals who have a religious exemption. You know, for religious purposes, they can't get vaccinated.
And so those are the pros and cons related to whether employers should mandate the vaccine. But as far as the law goes, Lee, can employers mandate this?
Yes, the law is very clear on that. And the EEOC recently came out with some guidance that said that, in fact, employers can mandate, but they do need to make sure that they have exceptions for individuals that need religious accommodations or disability accommodations.
Is there something unique about this particular situation, Lee, considering that this vaccine went through an emergency authorization process, something that we're not all that familiar with? Does that impact the law at all?
It does not impact the law. It does perhaps make some employees feel uncomfortable because of the quick manner in which this was done. But there are some employers, particularly in the healthcare area, that have been mandating that their employees get flu vaccines for years.
We're talking with Lee Geiger. He's an attorney at Graydon. When we think about lining up to get this vaccine, we're all hopeful that it returns us to some sense of normalcy, and I guess we'll have to see what the timeline is for that, but I'm sure employers want that as well. What is the authoritative body that employers turn to for guidance on how to handle this?
There is not one definitive body out there, but I guess the EEOC would probably be the one that most employers would be concerned with, because they are the administrative agency that addresses discrimination based on religion and disability. Within Ohio, you've also got the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. Within Kentucky, you've got the Kentucky Labor Cabinet as well.
What do you think employers are doing right now? And I imagine that you're dealing with some of them. What are their main questions or concerns as the vaccine, now two vaccines, start to make their way across the country?
We've been telling employers that now is the time to figure out whether you want to do this or not. Do you want to go down the path of mandating or not go down that path? And figure out, okay, if you're going to mandate, what's your policy going to be? What's the application going to be? And then also to be practical about it. The fact of the matter is that we're not likely to have vaccines available for everyone until at least August. And then also employers need to figure out what they're going to do with employees that refuse to get the vaccine.
Here at Cincinnati Public Radio, we've been working with a very limited crew inside the building. Those of us who host programming, we're here with engineers and some producers, but the bulk of our workforce has been working remotely. I know that we're all anxious to be back together again as soon as it's safe, but determining when it's safe may come down to an individual. If someone feels, even post-vaccine, that it's still not yet safe in their mind for them to return to the indoor traditional workspace. What type of rights do they have in requesting that they be able to work from home?
I know this is going to sound harsh, but in most cases where we're not dealing with a religious or a disability accommodation, those individuals really do not have the right to refuse to come to work, in much the same way that they can't refuse to wear protective equipment. They can't refuse to wear a mask. They can't refuse to wear safety shoes or safety goggles or anything like that. It's all going to be part of the job.
So it will come down to employers looking at the lay of the land within their own workspace and saying, now it's safe enough for this number of people to return?
That's absolutely correct.
And what about a situation in which employers want to know who's been vaccinated? Do they get, I don't know, whatever the equivalent of a receipt might be from whoever might administer the vaccine to the employees?
So the EEOC does have some guidance around that, and they make it very clear it is okay for you to ask whether or not the person has been vaccinated, but you really need to limit your questioning to that. So what I would encourage people to do is to have, if you're going to go down the route of mandatory vaccinations, and not all companies are, some have very deliberately decided they're not going to go down that path. But if you're going to go down that path, you need to get the employee to sign something and actually have their medical provider sign something that says that they've been vaccinated. Now, that medical provider could be a doctor, could be a clinic, it could be somebody else, you know, the pharmacy that gave the shot. But you get the documentation, but then don't ask anything else. Don't ask about, you know, other medical conditions that they may have.
And we're talking with Lee Geiger, an attorney with Graydon. So we're watching the vaccine roll out now, and we're paying close attention to the various tiers of people who are able to get them at this point and which portion of the population might come next. How will the availability of the vaccine impact employers' decisions on what they should or should not do as it relates to their employees? I imagine there's a supply and demand component to all this.
Absolutely. From a real nuts and bolts standpoint, if the vaccine's not available, you're not going to be able to mandate that people get the vaccine. Now, that may mean that you exclude certain people from the workplace because they don't have the vaccine. So what do I mean by that? Well, that may mean that you decide that those folks continue remote working until they do get vaccinated.
What are you seeing, Lee, as it relates to this broadly defined essential worker? We know that the first group of essential workers that are to get the vaccine are the frontline healthcare workers and also people who worked in grocery stores, those essential industries that have kept society going as best it can during this pandemic. But we're looking at the list, and my goodness, even media is on there, right? So, like, what are you hearing from employers about how they should go about classifying who should be in line and when for the vaccine?
I think that that is such a gray area right now. When the pandemic started and states were saying that only essential workers could come to work, what surprised me was just how broadly that definition was drafted. And most of our clients, it seemed, fell into the category of essential worker in one way or another. So I think that's going to be a very difficult line to draw.
Lee, when we think about ways to incentivize getting the vaccine, have you heard from any employers who are exploring the possibility of, oh, I don't know, maybe writing checks or giving cash to employees who agree to be vaccinated?
I have not talked to any companies yet that are doing that. It could be that they try to incentivize employees in that way, much like you would try to incentivize employees to quit smoking or to lose weight. This is a little different because when you incentivize someone to quit smoking or lose weight, you are protecting them. In this case, if you're mandating the vaccine, you're protecting or encouraging the vaccine. You're protecting the employee, but you're also protecting their coworkers.
So there's also a bottom line issue, I imagine, here. I mean, if you have to shut down any sector of your workspace because somebody has tested positive, that's going to impact the amount of revenue that's available to you. So there are economics involved here too, I imagine.
Certainly. Economics on both sides of the equation. It's the how much does it cost to have to shut down or slow down your business versus how much does it cost to pay employees to get the shot.
What can employers do as it relates to sick pay or paid leave next year if they somehow tie that to vaccinations? Is that a possibility?
I suppose that it could be a possibility. That's one that would be on an employer by employer basis. And I would really want to talk to the employers and see what their current PTO offerings are before we went down the path of paid sick leave.
We're talking with Lee Geiger, an attorney with Graydon. Lee, we've heard the word unprecedented a lot this year as it relates to a lot of different impacts that the COVID-19 pandemic has had for the past many months. I'm wondering, in your line of work, how were attorneys who specialize in this type of area able to prepare for handling vaccines? I mean, there was a point even just a couple of months ago, it felt like, where we weren't exactly sure when a vaccine would be available. So how are you all quickly adjusting to understanding what the law might be here?
It's funny, Michael, when this pandemic first hit back in March, I started telling people I'm no longer an employment lawyer, I'm a COVID lawyer. The difference between the vaccine part and what happened back in May, or March, April, and May, is that there was no way to predict that. The vaccine side, though, there is some prediction. And we started warning our clients back in the September, October timeframe, hey, there will be a vaccine. It is time to start thinking about whether or not you're going to require your employees. So in this one case, there really could be some planning that went into it. And there was some precedent from the EEOC about whether or not you could mandate that employees get vaccines.
Was there anything in particular that surprised you as you studied up on that?
No, not really. The EEOC's position has been pretty consistent. Particularly looking at flu shots was where things were the most common in the healthcare area. And so they were able to kind of refine that guidance and really, you know, very recently made it clear that employers can require the vaccine.
If you were to look in your lawyer crystal ball, what type of vaccine specific litigation do you see employers possibly having to deal with or employees having to deal with?
I think that there is likely to be probably some religious discrimination claims and perhaps disability discrimination claims by people that refuse to get vaccinated for religious or disability purposes. And the EEOC has said that you can exclude those people from the workplace. And that sounds very easy until you determine, well, what does that mean? Because the EEOC does not want you terminating their employment. So it might mean that those individuals that for religious or disability purposes can't get vaccinated would need to be provided an accommodation to work remotely, which works fine if you're an office worker, but might not work fine if you're a factory worker.
Well, to that end, I wanted to ask, are there particular industries that you envision, I don't know, maybe being more litigious during this because of the nature of the work they do?
No, not necessarily. It's been my experience that people in all industries tend to be, when you have a bad employee, they're a bad or frustrating employee, regardless of which industry they're in.
We've been talking with Lee Geiger, attorney at Graydon. Lee, thank you so much for the assistance you gave us and understanding the role of employers and mandates around the COVID-19 vaccines. We appreciate the time you gave us.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to do this.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.